Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It's May 7th, and I would like to open a public hearing. Is Representative Clam here yet? Okay, then I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3128. Is Reardon here, Representative Reardon? Nathanson?
Yeah. If you want to go.
Well, none of these are here, so.
But she's here for Reardon.
Okay. Okay, so I will close temporarily House Bill 2028, or 3128, I guess, is what I opened. And yeah, okay. Let's open public hearing on House Bill 3128 and call Ann Bazzini.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3128 designates March of each year as Multiple System Atrophy Awareness Month. This bill left the House floor 59 ayes with one excuse for legislative business.
Is Ann Bazzini here? I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3128. Is there anyone here to testify on HCR 16A? Is there anyone here testifying on HB 2020? Oh, there's here. There's. I'm going to open a public hearing on HCR 16A. Representative Clem.
Members of the committee, Madam Chair, HCR 16A recognizes addiction as a disease, defines addiction as a chronic relapsing brain disease affecting an individual's behavior. The resolution also resolves that prevention and treatment address biological, behavioral, and environmental factors. No revenue or fiscal impact on the bill. This left the House floor with 45 ayes and 15 nays.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21, which is here in Salem. And I think he's here, but my partner in crime on this is a candidate who's run, I don't like to call it against me, but he's run at the same with me for my job the last two.
You're so tactful, Representative.
The last two elections, Marvin, and he has been really actually a great person to help educate kids in this community, particularly about addiction. And if he were here, he would talk about some tragic situations in his own life that led him to want to kind of take on as a crusade, getting particularly to younger people about getting help for addiction. But his big message that I've been persuaded by over the last several years was, as a state, we need to understand that addiction is not it's not a moral lapse. It's not a you have bad character. It's an actual disease, and that's the way the National Institute of Health defines it and categorizes it. And that's the amendment that passed to make this the A engrossed. Was Representative Greenlick, who chairs the committee, said, you know, I was involved in helping write this at the time, and it's an actual chronic relapsing brain disorder. So then we went and found the definition, and that was amended into the bill. And again, it's a resolution, so it's not binding, but it had, in the House at least, it had a practical effect. The very next week, we had a bill that was dealing with, you may end up seeing it here, was dealing with people who had I think, driving under the influence type issues with their insurance company, and who should pay, the insurance industry or the person who had the driving under the influence. And one of the focuses of the conversation was, well, if it's truly an illness, if alcoholism is an illness, then it should be covered by insurance just like anything else. So the resolution, actually about a week later, I talked myself into voting for it under my own theory here that I'm proposing in this resolution. And it's not that people don't answer for their crimes when they're addicted and do something. Nobody's arguing we should be doing that. It's just understanding that we would be better off if we view addiction as a disease and try and treat it medically instead of just assuming that person is somehow bad or a failure, and that doesn't really do any good for the addict. And several of us have this issue in our own personal families, and we've had to figure out how to struggle with it on a personal level, and this is just a statement from the legislature how we view it.
Thank you. Is there any discussion?
Great bill.
Is the okay? Yeah. Is the committee comfortable with going forward? Thank you, Representative Krim. There's no one else signed up to this bill. There seems to be no opposition to this bill, so I will close the public hearing on HCR 16 and open a work session on HCR 16.
Madam Chair, I move that HCR 16 be sent to the Senate floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves HCR 16 to the floor with a do adopt resolution, or with a do adopt. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steiner Hayward. Aye. Senator Knopf.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Excused.
Chair
Robinson. Aye. Motion carries. And who would like to carry this bill?
I'll take it if nobody else wants it.
I'd like Senator Steiner Hayward would love to carry this bill, and I will close the work session on HCR 16. And is someone from Reardon's office here for House Bill 3128? Okay. Is Nathanson here for House Bill 2020? Is there anyone here to testify on House Bill 2020?
Let me see. Yes.
Yeah, they've got several.
Okay. So I was hoping that Representative Nathanson could start us off, but who is the group to start this off?
Janet.
Okay.
Yeah, probably these guys.
All right. Let's have Janet Aren, Stacy Bloomberg, and Tin, is it Steckler?
Tia,
I'm sorry.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. We appreciate the bill sponsors and the chair, and of course our chief sponsor, Representative Nathanson. My name is Janet Aren. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs, and I represent over 40 other nonprofits and for-profit organizations who take care of kids. That's about $205 million to the small business in Oregon and over 100,000 children. The very first statement and the most important statement that we'd like to make, except, of course, thanking the committee and the bill sponsors, is to also recognize how important our relationship is with the CCOs and the shared goals and objectives that we have to take care of kids, take care of their families, achieve a triple aim, and achieve the cost savings that we need in the transformation for Oregon. So House Bill 2020 is a beautiful bill. It's got a great deal of opportunity, and it has an option for a win-win for everybody to help with the cost savings, help with the reduction of time and money for all. It eliminates unnecessary gaps and disruptions for services. It keeps consumers access for their services and streamlines the process significantly. So Representative Nathanson was going to talk a little bit about what the bill does, so I'll just touch briefly on it. The bill primarily addresses behavioral health providers, so drug and alcohol and mental health providers for children and adults. It creates a single standard for credentialing with coordinated care organizations, and it also creates reciprocity between the coordinated care organizations. So in the first days, I just wanted to acknowledge the help of the Oregon Health Authority in developing the bill as we went forward. And Bruce Goldberg commented very early on when we first met with him about the idea that this is really a great bill and exactly what we want to see happen.
Hey, Representative Nathanson's here, so let's...
That would be great.
We've started your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. Shall I just start with an opening?
Just start with
Okay, thanks. Mental health and chemical dependency treatment providers for both children and adults must go through multiple authorizations to operate in different coordinated care organization areas. Multiple authorizations. This is mostly an unnecessary use of time. It's costly to the providers. It's a 2 to 3 day process for providers, but I maintain it's also costly for CCOs to do multiple authorizations time after time while we're asking them to operate under extremely pressured circumstances right now, bringing on healthcare transformation. So it's using up CCO resources, it's using up provider resources. I first learned about this going through multiple authorizations and multiple credentialing processes from one of the long-standing nonprofit organizations in my own community that's very well respected. It affects organizations such as Homestead Youth Services in Pendleton, Tillamook Family Counseling, Trillium Family Services in Corvallis, Northwest Human Services in Salem, OnTrack in Medford, LifeWorks, Columbia Care, DePaul, many, many different provider organizations. They're all licensed by the state of Oregon. They are certified by the Oregon Health Authority to be a behavioral health provider. Then there's an additional layer of credentialing that happens next at the CCO level in any CCO region where that provider will have clients. It may be in 1 or 2 or 5 or 6 CCO areas. We're not talking about being annoyed by filling out a form. That is an annoyance, and some of you know I've been working on that sort of stuff with trying to streamline government. This isn't an annoyance, and it's not just an extra form. A credentialing review takes 2 to 3 days, and it involves several people. It's a burden for providers in any community across the state. This bill establishes provider reciprocity, and I want to emphasize this is about providers that are organizations. This is not about individual practitioners. It's about programs. So that once a program provider is vetted and found to be qualified by one CCO, then they will be recognized as qualified for other CCOs. Oregon Health Authority will work with an advisory committee to adopt the rules for credentialing so that everyone can be on board and be comfortable with the set of rules that's being adopted. To sum up, the objective of this bill is to reduce redundancy, to reduce duplicative administrative processes, and make sure that we're spending the maximum amount of time for the providers to deliver services and the maximum amount of time for CCOs to manage their business, not doing multiple authorizations. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's hear from the panel and then we'll open it up for questions.
So having put that information together that Representative Nathanson just explained, we built some talking points and put some...
And Janet, restate your name.
Yes, Janet Ahrens. Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs, thank you. And we put some talking points and some information together that we wanted to distribute to legislators, and we also shared that with the CCOs. We had both individual conversations with them as well as a meeting with them. They pointed out some changes that they thought were necessary, which we accommodated and gave us the feedback that we thought was very important to have. And we ended up with 4 amendments to the bill as it moved through the House. The House Human Services and Housing Committee passed it out unanimously with a do-pass recommendation, and it moved through the House 58-0 with no opposition. There are, however, some new concerns, as I understand it. Now, I have to be a little bit careful here because I haven't seen any paperwork. Nobody's given me any bulleted talking points or backup information, so I could be wrong here, but if I understand it correctly, the key issues that are raised now are the inability to extend reciprocity without creating a new dense layer of cross-auditing along with some other procedures, and also a concern about being out of compliance with a federal organization that offers accreditation to CCOs. That's the National Committee for Quality Assurance. So I had an opportunity to talk to the Assistant Director for Policy Accreditation and Standards and Guidelines at NCQA and about the credentialing program that we offer in the bill and about the work that we want to do about licensing in Oregon and also about the Oregon Health Authority Addictions and Mental Health Division's certification of providers. He indicated the following information for me, and it's in the packet that I gave you. CCOs can collectively develop and execute a single set of policies and standards for site visits that are uniform. NCQA refers to these specifically as collaboratives. Collaboratives are currently in several states. In a collaborative, one CCO can do a site visit. Now, they talk about a site visit, but what they really mean is the accreditation process, not just the actual going to visit the provider. Can do a site visit and share the results with other CCOs. No audits of one CCO by another CCO is required to verify fidelity. The state of Oregon has the ability to set its own elements for credentialing, and NCQA will never vary from the state requirement, and that's his exact term. The Oregon Health Authority, Addictions and Mental Health, has its own certification process, which I mentioned, and NCQA indicated that they will accept this process as a proxy. They don't even refer to it, and he was specific about this, as reciprocity. They consider it a proxy, as a proxy for a CCO site visit, as long as they continue to review the accreditations and the sites every 36 months, which is actually a longer period apart than we currently do ours. So we think that's very good news. The director also indicated that CCOs can use Oregon's licensing and the credentialing in place of other accreditation processes. So while we still have lots of challenges in front of us, and this is not going to be easy, and it can be messy, and I can just see a flow chart of spaghetti underneath some of the administrative rules and processes that CCOs may currently have in place, I think there's a great opportunity here. And when you hear from DePaul, and I'm sorry that Tia Grace Decker is late from Morrison, and when you hear from her about her programs and the credentialing needs, you'll see that between the two of these organizations, this is before anybody else is included, to get their programs credentialed for the statewide population they serve will take 435 credentialing processes. So it's hard to imagine something that's more complicated than that. So I just wanted to close with a comment about my grandparents and my grandfather, who's a plaid-shirted gentleman who always had a cigar clenched in his teeth. And sitting at the dinner table, when I was in high school, I was complaining about a science project that I had to do with a bunch of my schoolmates. And I was making all kinds of excuses for why I didn't want to do it. And he looked at me and said, "You can find 100 reasons not to do it. You only need to find one reason to get it done." Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we are. Thank you.
Thank you. As Janet mentioned, I'm with DePaul Treatment Centers. I'm Stacey Blumberg, the Director of Marketing and Development. And with my role, part of my responsibilities are maintaining our relationships with the different providers that we contract with insurance companies and moving forward the CCOs. So the credentialing process is something that I'm very familiar with. DePaul served over...
You need to state your name.
You did. Stacey Blumberg. Okay. Sorry about that. DePaul served over 2,000 people last year doing chemical dependency and treatment for co-occurring mental health disorders out of three locations, two in Multnomah County and one in Washington County. That include clients from 26 counties in Oregon. All 15 of the CCOs are represented in that area. So we are looking at contracting with all 15 of them. We have 11 different programs across those three locations. So this definitely will be a very time-consuming process for us. And like many of the nonprofit organizations we work with, our resources are very limited, and we definitely want to spend all the resources we can actually serving our clients as opposed to doing the administrative work with the credentialing processes. Credentialing for us takes a minimum of half a day for an employee and often can take a full of 3 or 4 days. The packets often exceed 50 pages in length. It definitely is a time-consuming process with a lot of redundancies. And we just wanted to state to you that this bill really does further the triple aim by enabling us and the other providers that we work with to be able to really spend our resources treating people and lowering the costs. So that we can have better outcomes and serve more of the people that are needing our services. Thank you very much.
Thank you. There have been some CCOs coming forward, and they will be testifying.
with concerns, and I'm hoping that you will be able to work together to come to consensus. Is that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I certainly think so. It also might be that the information that we are receiving just in the last hours, because we just became aware of this concern of theirs in the last few working days, frankly. But we worked very fast to try to understand then very specifically what the issues were. And through our contact with NCQA, it seems to me that some of the things that they raised, I think very legitimately, how will this impact our own aspirations for being credentialed with NCQA if they're not already, or if they already are, will this jeopardize their qualification, will it jeopardize anything about the way they are reviewed, their authorizations and so forth. I think with the information that we have just found, it will put their concerns to rest, but I want to be able to share that information very specifically with each of them, and we hope that if necessary we can even involve assistant director, I think that's mm-hmm. what it is, the assistant director for the policies and standards who has been providing the information to us. Perhaps we could even join in a conference, even if it's a conference telephone call, so that everyone can discuss it, make sure that all the information is understood. I also think that there's a lot that's that was meant in the bill when it says very simply that the Oregon Health Authority will work with an advisory committee, and then it lists who all should be included on the advisory committee. If it would become important to the CCOs to have it clarified more what the advisory committee should work on and under what time frame and when when things would be put in place, I think that would be just fine. I think we can address everyone's concerns and still move forward, because it seems like the NCQA is telling us, yes, they do it in other states. They have the cooperatives. They have the proxy system in place. And I think we should be able to do that in Oregon as well.
All right. Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to make it clear, I support this concept of this bill strongly. I think it's a really good idea, and it's very analogous to Senate Bill 569, which yes. many people were involved with, which is the telemedicine credentialing bill that we passed off the Senate floor earlier this session. That being said, things I've heard and things that I'm reading again today and then things I've heard today have me a little confused, and I'm very eager to work. If I can be helpful, I'm very eager to work with whoever's interested. But I'm a little confused about the definition of providers, because I thought, Representative Nathanson, that I heard you say a provider is an organization, but then I thought I heard other people say that providers are individuals. Mm-hmm. So, right, but I'm still a little confused about that. And one of the reasons I'm confused is that historically when we talk about providers, in most of the medical world, that means individuals. So that may require a language clarification. It may be just putting in the word provider organizations or provider groups or however we want to define them, but I'm just pointing that out as one thing that I would add. The other thing is that it might perhaps, and I'm not holding out 569 as a model of perfection, because I'm sure there's problems with, there could be problems with it too, but one of the things that we came up with for that one that helped everybody feel more comfortable was to develop a standard list of credentialing stuff that absolutely should be requested when there was cross-credentialing going on between originating site hospitals and distant site hospitals, for example, and then a list that could be requested, and then a list that couldn't be requested. Now, that couldn't be requested probably aren't going to reply as much, but it did add a little bit of local control, as it were, because different CCOs may have different needs, especially for different types of provider organizations. So I want to be sure that even with the notwithstanding language in there, that which I think is very appropriate to have, that says that they're not required to contract, I would want to be sure that there was real clarity in there, in the language of the bill, frankly, that addresses the fact that there ought to be sort of a standard set of agreements, but that if a CCO needed to request something additional, that there was a list of things that would be considered acceptable. It wasn't a guaranteed one-size-fits-all, because I am a little bit worried about regional differences. I don't want to increase the burden by any means, but I think it would be possible to keep credential files that would work in these scenarios, I think. And as I said, I'm eager to be helpful if I can, because I think it's a good bill in principle.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I would just encourage us as a committee to, while we're trying to get the CCOs and the community-based organizations that provide these services to come to resolution, I think we should also make it clear that it is our desire to pass a bill so that if impasse happens, that you still know that we want to pass your bill as is. So I would really encourage the CCOs to come to the table in good faith, fix these issues quickly, and pass a bill, because this bill just says to me, I can't believe we haven't done this before, and I can't imagine a better way to save resources that we're going to vitally need. So I just want to put that message out there.
You.
Hopefully we can send the message that we really want to pass this bill and encourage the parties to negotiate well.
Great.
Madam Chair, I wanted to thank you and say that I take all of your comments to heart. We will make note of that, continue listening, looking at the language to see where it needs to be clarified or expanded. I'll point out that on page 2, line 9, it says, as used in this subsection, providers does not include individual practitioners. But if that needs to be moved to a different section for some reason, we will check with Legislative Council to make sure that it's in the right place so that it's very clearly understood. We'll double and triple check all of this and include certainly all of your comments and those that we'll hear from the CCOs to provide clarification and direction where it will be helpful.
Great. All right. Thank you. And Tia Steckler, and then Janet Meyer and Josh Bollock.
I'll go ask her again.
No. Tia, did you want to testify? She just called you to the table.
Do I have to go back?
You can sit down. And
no.
Then let's have Tia. I want Tia to do her testimony first.
Hi. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee. I'm Tia Gray. I am the CEO of Morrison Child and Family Services. We are the largest provider of mental health services to kids in the state. So we serve about 6,000 children from across Oregon. Hi.
So you were signed up as Steckler, but it's Gray?
It's Gray.
Gray, okay.
I got divorced last year.
So that's why they were using the
wrong
name.
We can talk
name.
About that later. Right.
Apparently.
Okay.
Names are complicated.
Sorry about that.
Continue.
So we provide an array of services, so we have 22 different programs, and we checked today, we double-checked our programs. We have 18 programs that could be impacted by this, so we have 18 programs that take kids from across the state. And so if you have a program, a provider has a program that serves, say, 25 kids at a time on an ongoing basis, there's potential that those 25 kids can come from, you know, 20 different places in the state, which means can presently mean 20 different sets of credentialing, 20 different sets of billing, 20 different, then all that flows from that, the rules that are applied by each CCO. And so the importance for us of, you know, in a time of limited resources, which is all the time in Oregon, that we put as many of the resources we can to bear on providing high quality programming to kids, and those services that don't get driven down to kids, that those dollars and resources be spent on monitoring for high quality and for performance outcomes is just incumbent upon us as people who manage those resources. And so I want to just really encourage you guys to continue in the thoughtful process that you're going through with House Bill 2020.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tim? Chair Bonus Anderson, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 2020. My name is Janet Meyer, and I am the CEO of HealthShare of Oregon. We are one of the CCOs operating in the Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington County area. you know, I couldn't agree more with the need to streamline and make the credentialing process more efficient. As somebody who's been wrestling with this onerous process for a couple decades now, I would lead the charge gladly to make any improvements we could. Having said that, we have a couple concerns with this, the way this bill is proposing to address it. And what we're really hoping is that we can have a little more time to sit down with the sponsors of the bill and try and work out something that we think would be a win-win for both parties. Our concerns specifically are that it creates a complex structure for the CCOs to administer, and I would like to reassure the sponsors that there is currently a credentialing collaborative in the works right now in Oregon. It's been operating for quite a while. So that process is already established. There are a few Medicaid plans that participate in that collaborative, but not all do. So we're very versed in delegated credentialing and how the audit process works. We've all, many of us have participated in that for years. But what we're asking is that we stop for a little bit, think about how we're approaching this for this class of providers. One of our other concerns is that we're making things more complex maybe than they need to be. HealthShare has recommended that we ask the state to allow us to have some contract language that lets us use state licensure and county certification in lieu of credentialing. Now, that proposal may or may not solve the concerns of the plans that are accredited by the National Committee on Quality Assurance, but we're working closely with those plans to come up with a possible solution that would not involve CCOs delegating credentialing to each other. It's the inter-CCO structure that we're concerned about. Can it be done? You bet. Have we done it in other markets and in other business lines? Yes. Not sure this is the right place to apply that. One of the reasons you do delegated credentialing is to get efficiencies. And we don't have enough providers in this pool to get a lot of efficiency out of a delegated credentialing arrangement. So, for instance, many of us delegate credentialing to OHSU. That makes sense. There's thousands of providers involved with OHSU. Delegating to them is a no-brainer. Probably aren't going to be delegating to a very small provider group. There's just not the efficiency there. We believe there's an alternative way that will both get the providers out of the onerous process and having the CCOs avoid that inter-CCO delegation and contract relationship. So we're trying to work as quickly as we can, and I personally apologize for our failure to communicate our concerns when the bill was in the House. We were remiss at that point. I'm an optimist. You would have to be an optimist to be the CEO of HealthShare, so I really thought we could work out some alternatives, and I think that's why we've now come with all due haste to say, let's figure this out, and let's figure it out in a way that doesn't further complicate the administrative structures.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Jeff.
Chairman Sanderson, member of the committee, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Josh Ballack, representing the Coalition for Healthy Oregon, and I am also happily married, so if that matters. Representing the Coalition for Healthy Oregon, we really appreciate the sponsor of this bill's effort to be able to cut red tape and make a more efficient model. Our fear is that this bill could have some unintended consequences. We would like to echo a lot of what Ms. Meyer just said around making the trying to figure out ways that we can mitigate some of these unintended consequences. One of the issues that has popped up in a couple different places is around the NCQA. I unfortunately am not an expert inside of that, so we're actually working with them trying to figure out exactly what it is, but they're under the impression that you would have to enter into a bunch of different contracts with each individual CCO. Not only does that create a headache, but also their fear is that you would actually have more pressure put on you to actually do more auditing because you've got a different group doing the credentialing, which would only be a headache for the provider and also for the CCO. So, and liability is still a concern and kind of how that all those pieces will come together. But we are very committed to try to figure out a way to be able to address the underlying issue, to be able to help our very necessary partners in this, and hopefully we can find a way. So With that, I'd like to thank the committee and thank the sponsor as well for bringing this forward.
Great.
Yeah. I'm sorry, if you would, Chair Montes Anderson. I do have the definition of provider that's in our CCO contract, and provider does mean, and this is referencing our OARs, provider means an individual, facility, institution, corporate entity, or other organization. So it's broader. When we use the word provider, we mean any institution or entity that's delivering services, healthcare services. So okay. Just to clarify.
Thank you. And you will be willing to work with the sponsors of the bill?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. And will Representative Nathanson's office take charge of that? Okay. All right. The last two are Rose Englert, three, Jeremy Vandehey and Mario Parker Milligan.
I'll start.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rose Englert here for CARE Oregon. CARE Oregon is currently the only Medicaid plan that is NCQA accredited. So I can speak with some degree of authority on these things. We do support an easier path and a collaborative approach, but unfortunately the bill as written does not get us as an NCQA plan to those places. Briefly, and you guys probably should have had this from the beginning, NCQA is the National Committee on Quality Assurance. It's a respected third-party validation of quality and value in a plan, and the accreditation standards are the most rigorous in the health insurance industry. It's a comprehensive evaluation of health plans around clinical measures and consumer experience. Kaiser is also an accredited plan on the Medicare and commercial side, and we are also an accredited plan on Medicare, and we're going through the commercial accreditation right now. I have, from the NCQA handbook, what we have to do around credentialing. First, we have to confirm that the organization is in good standing with state and regulatory bodies. That's paperwork. That's easy. The second, for a facility, we have to confirm that the organization has been reviewed and approved by an accrediting body. So for hospitals, that's something like JCO. And for the facilities that we're talking about in this bill, however, there is no accrediting body for those facilities. If there's no accrediting body, NCQA requires that we perform an on-site quality assessment survey if the organization is not accredited. You heard earlier Janet Meyer speaking about a state review. There is a caveat to the on-site quality assessment survey that we must do that says we can substitute a CMS or a state review in lieu of a site visit. So we do approve of the plan to allow the state to do these reviews, and we could accept those as an accredited plan. While we cannot, under the bill as written, we cannot substitute another CCO's certification, or credentialing, excuse me, as our credentialing. We can, however, as Janet Aaron suggested, work on a collaborative process. CARE Oregon is a member of some of the credentialing collaboratives in the state right now, and we actually have a meeting with the proponent of the bill on Monday to talk about how we can do these NCQA allowable collaboratives, possibly without legislation, or if we need to do legislation, we'll figure out how to make that work in a bill. So any questions? That's all I've got.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Vandehey with Kaiser Permanente. Just want to piggyback on what the other folks who testified today are. I'll be brief. First of all, I just want to, thank Representative Nathanson and the proponents for bringing this issue forward. We also agree that streamlining is always an important thing, and want to apologize for being a little bit late to the game for raising some concerns. Kaiser's, we're a commercial plan. We also provide for Medicaid, both through health share as well as through a direct contract for Marion and Polk County. We are NCQA accredited. We're excellent accreditation, which means we meet more than 95% or more of the benchmarks that are required for NCQA. It's something that we take very, very seriously. I think part of the reason that we're a little late to the game here is there was some confusion around terms and in the bill. The bill talks about credentialing providers, and that's normally how those terms are used when you talk about credentialing an individual provider and figuring out if they actually did graduate from school and actually do have a license. But I think the bill here is actually aimed at organizations and facilities, And NCQA talks about those as doing an organizational assessment. And so it's just a little bit different terminology, which is why we kind of figured out once that language was added that a provider doesn't actually mean an individual provider. We're like, well, what does this mean exactly? And we kind of figured out this means programs and organizations. And so NCQA does have standards for how you do this assessment, like Rose talked about. One of the issues here is around the site visit. And our understanding, and I want to check with OHA about this, but my understanding is that the state used to do these a little more frequently, and so they could be relied on by individual plans. They aren't happening as frequently as are necessary in order to keep your NCQA accreditation, which means you then have to go out and do your own individual site visit. And so I think if that's really the issue here, I think there might be some solutions to try to figure out how to align those. You know, maybe have an open house where you sort of try to get everybody aligned on the same day. I think there's some more discussion that needs to happen to try to figure out exactly what the problem is and how there could be a solution. Certainly don't want not trying to kill this bill. We just want to make sure that we don't jeopardize our NCQA accreditation in the process. And I think it's important to note that all exchange plans that are offered in the exchange have to be accredited through either NCQA or another organization, URAC, I think is what. So it is an important issue, and obviously if this bill did pass and somehow jeopardizes NCQA accreditation, that'd be an issue for, you know, all the plans in the state. So all I would ask for is just a little bit of time to sort of work through this with the proponents, with Representative Nathanson and anybody else, and just make sure we get to a solution that doesn't jeopardize accreditation. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. And if there are amendments proposed, I would like you to coordinate through our committee administrator. She seems to be very proficient at getting amendments back quickly from legislative council. So we'll do it that way. All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2020 and open a public hearing on HB 3128. And Ann Vizzini.
Could I make a comment before we go? Madam Chair, I just want to let you and those in the audience know that I was anticipating on testifying for HB 2611. I'm very proud of that bill and that the way that the proponents moved that through the House. Unfortunately, I have to pick up my kids from childcare today, so I'm going to have to excuse myself, but I just wanted to put on the record that I'm very supportive.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ann Buzzini. I'm a legislative aide to Representative Reardon. I'm here today just to kind of introduce you to House Bill 3128, which would designate March as Multiple System Atrophy Awareness Month. This bill was requested by a constituent of ours. Her name is Charmaine Bichel. Charmaine lost her husband, Dr. John Bichel, to MSA several years ago. The disease is a neurodegenerative disorder with symptoms not dissimilar to Parkinson's. There is no cure and no treatment to slow the neurodegeneration. So all doctors can do is try to keep their patients comfortable. The incidence is fairly rare, really rare, actually. And as a result, many doctors don't even know that the disease exists, which makes it very hard to diagnose. So MSA is fatal, but their family members have been coming together across the United States trying to get bills passed in each state house, which would designate March as MSA Awareness Month so that they can receive more research funding to bring more awareness to the disease.
Great. Questions? What's the difference between multiple sclerosis and multiple system atrophy?
You know, I don't know. My knowledge of the disease is pretty limited to what I've heard from our constituent, but I'd be happy to get the answer to that to you promptly.
All right. I don't have a quorum, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3128. And you can sign that. Okay, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2134.
And I thought Representative Kenny Geyer was going to be here, but
She's not here yet, but I'll brief you, Madam Chair. Member of the committee requires the Oregon 2134A requires the Oregon Health Authority and Department of Human Services to adopt rules using an advisory committee, uniform standards for collection of data on race, ethnicity, preferred languages, and disability status of public assistance recipients. Provides the bill also provides the necessary standards to be based on the local, statewide, and national best practices for data collection. It requires that they report or file a report with the appropriate legislative committees on the implementation. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. You do have an A3 amendment in your packet that I believe they will speak to and assistant clarification, but that amendment broadens the language to allow the Oregon Health Authority and DHS to use existing public health surveys or other data collected from other programs. The floor vote was 55 ayes with 4 excused. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal.
All right, Joseph Santos Lyons and Dr. Kenny Nguyen Hong.
Was that
5-4?
Yes.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having us today, and thank you, Senator, for your support of this bill over the last 6 months. For the record, my name is Joseph Santos Lyons. I'm the director of APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. And we're an organization that, along with our partners, believes in an Oregon where everyone has access to the health care they need, and that good health is the foundation of community prosperity. And for generations, many of our communities have been making contributions to our economy and to society, but yet some of us still really face disparities in health and human services. And despite our best efforts, real differences still do exist in the various outcomes of different communities. And part of that is due to serious data gaps and outdated collection practices. These things result in inefficiency and also raise costs for all of us. For example, collecting data on Asian and Pacific Islanders as other or Asian rules out meaningful use of data across agency programs. This lack of data masks expensive health disparities. Oregon will benefit from consistent, accurate, and useful data. This will allow programs and services to best meet the needs of our diverse communities. And we know that the wrong focus equals the wrong results, and what is measured matters in decision-making. So this bill is about collecting accurate information about race, ethnicity, language, and disability status in a practical and reliable manner. And these are really evidence-based solutions for addressing disparities to achieve better health for all. So you have before you House Bill 2134A, which will also have a -3 amendment, which we'll ask you to adopt when you work the bill. The bill gives rulemaking authority to OHA and DHS to adopt uniform standards based on best practices for the collection of data. Uniform standards will provide the consistency and accuracy needed in order to adequately assess the status and needs of different groups here in Oregon. The bill also provides for ongoing stakeholder engagement and a review and update of standards every 2 years to stay current with best practices. The bill does not have an implementation deadline, but does require OHA and DHS to report back by June of 2014 on the standards and a plan to implement across the agency. We are working in partnership with OHA and DHS to complete the -3 amendments. They're not quite done yet. We've got a couple more revisions to make. And we see this as a technical fix that really sort of clarifies the intent of the bill, which is that all OHA and DHS programs that collect demographic data, including things like public health surveys, are covered by the scope of the bill, and that the agencies are required to actually begin implementing and using the standards where, when feasible and practical. Just the quick final thing is the bill is supported by over 48 community-based organizations and other health organizations and groups within our communities of color that will really see a benefit from the bill. And we've submitted over 20 letters of support from health and human service groups and professionals. So thank you so much for your time today. And if you have any questions, let me know.
Thank you, Chairs. Monis Anderson and members of the committee. And for the record, my name is Connie, Dr. Connie Kim In Win Trung. Yes, it is a very long name. And I'm a nurse scientist and researcher at Oregon Health and Science University School of Nursing, and also the principal investigator of the Vietnamese Women's Health Project, phases 2 and 3, and also a registered licensed practicing nurse. And I want to provide an example of how having disaggregate data has impacted and helped our Vietnamese community. So the Vietnamese Women's Health Project was found due to a really grave concern about addressing an unmet community need. And at the national level, Vietnamese American women were diagnosed much higher and died at higher rates than that of white non-Hispanic women. And it's well supported in science that having regular cervical cancer screening increases the likelihood of early detection of precancerous and cancerous growths. So it stands to reason that this could prevent the deaths of many Vietnamese women. So in our community, we needed to conduct studies that would provide us with accurate current data so that we could appropriately examine how this was impacting health in our community. And based on local nonprofit community organizations, study findings of the Tri-County area of Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas County, it was found that only 74% of Vietnamese immigrant women had ever had cervical cancer screening at least once in their lifetime. And the Vietnamese Women's Health Project built on that study, and we did a survey, and then we found that only 69% had actually adhered to routine cervical cancer screening guidelines. So on a grade level from A through F, that is a D, which is really poor, and that's much lower compared to the Healthy People objectives, which is targeted that we want to have 93% that are adherent to these screening guidelines. So without accurate and current data, we would not have been able to generalize study findings to this particular at-risk subgroup, and therefore the Vietnamese Women's Health Project currently is able to develop a targeted intervention specifically for the Vietnamese community, and that is culturally and linguistically appropriate. And the consequences of not having this accurate data could have led us to develop inappropriate intervention, which is not cost efficient, and that would mean that we wouldn't have sustaining appropriate health outcomes. It would be poorer. And one of the most important things that I want to make sure I emphasize as a practicing nurse, I work with other primary health care providers to develop the best intervention possible for the patients we care for. But whenever I go to review the literature on these conditions, most of the time I find aggregated data across racial ethnic groups. And that makes it so hard to try to understand these cultural beliefs, these multiple influencing factors that are directly, that would have helped us to really understand what we mean when we say health disparities right there when we're caring for patients. And this is from my own experience with my own research in terms of how important it is to really consider racial and beliefs and cultural factors when we're caring for these communities. So we know that these inconsistencies in terms of data collections affect us, but we also know that it affects other communities of color. And we want to be able to understand in terms of which subgroup or group is experiencing this disproportionate burden of either a life-threatening illness or chronic illness disease. So we really need to have disaggregated data so that we can start to at least have a fundamental foundational how we go about even communicating and how we go about examining these health inequity and disparities. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kennegeier.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Alyssa Kennegeier, representative from House District 46, which is parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. And I'm really honored here to support this bill. This was a committee bill, not my own bill, but something I've been interested in many years as a board member of Northwest Health Foundation. One of the missions of that foundation is to really close the gaps and disparities for health outcomes for whoever is not thriving in our community, which tends to be communities of color and rural communities. And when we ask groups for data to support the strategies they're going after, we find that it's really hard when you don't have disaggregated data for the reasons that she just articulated. You know, you really just can't say Asian and Pacific Islander and expect the the health outcomes of Samoans to be similar to Japanese. They're very different genetics, very different cultural practices, and we can't design strategies to achieve our outcomes in health or, for instance, achievement compacts. We're trying to do the same thing in the 40-40-20 arena in our achievement compacts to really disaggregate the data so that we can get more specific about the strategies to improve health for all. So I am just here to support them. I know they've done that for many years. I don't know if the Reverend has had a chance to speak yet, but I know you've been involved for many years, and this comes out of years of work and following evidence-based practice. So I will
thank you.
Surrender
any
my
questions,
time.
Come in. Yes.
I just want to say thank you for bringing this bill. As a primary care physician myself and also someone who's traveled a fair amount in the world, I know what a big problem this is. I had the privilege last summer of visiting Thailand and Cambodia, which are two neighboring countries, and we were in a part of Cambodia where there are a lot of Vietnamese people as well, and I was talking with some community health workers there, and they were talking about the challenges even in the country itself of separating out different health beliefs and practices between the Cambodians and the Vietnamese who are living in close proximity to each other and in theory come from the same neck of the woods and would all get lumped, just as you said. And we certainly have this problem when I'm teaching medical students or residents on OHSU as well, and trying to help them understand that just because someone lists Asian and Pacific Islander or Pacific Islander as their ethnicity, it's just not. You cannot make assumptions about that for anything. That the beliefs of people from different parts of the forest are significant, and we've got to be more cognizant about that and to be able to do the kind of research that you're talking about. I think this is a great bill, and I'm really excited about it.
All right. Thank you very much. And I'd like to call up Tricia Tillman.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and committee. My name is Tricia Tillman, and I'm the director for the Office of Equity and Inclusion for the Oregon Health Authority. And I was asked to speak with you today, I think probably very briefly, about just an overview of health equity to help inform your discussions today.
PowerPoint?
It's here. I can just click through it.
Well, we're there. We go.
I hope. You don't want to hear. You don't want to hear me yammer on without the PowerPoint. Okay. Thank you. So there's a lot that I could talk about. I'm going to zip through a number of the slides just to keep this brief. So what is health equity? We talk a lot about health equity, but a lot of times people aren't really familiar with what that means. So this is the definition of health equity that comes from the Department of Health and Human Services. And it's really that all populations, and thinking about it in terms of Oregon, all populations all across the state attain the highest level of health that's possible. And in order to do this, it really requires that we value everyone equally. As Senator Steiner Hayward just mentioned, we really need to understand people's health beliefs and cultural practices, and then also address ongoing societal efforts to redress inequalities, both historically and contemporary, which means an investment over time, because these socially patterned disadvantages have been with us for generations. So the elimination of health disparities in health care and in living and working conditions that influence health, which we call the social determinants of health, require investment over time. So what are some of the causes of health inequities? So if we look really at the health care system, we can see that there are barriers in terms of who has access to health insurance, who doesn't. When you break this down, again, by race and ethnicity, we can see variations in who gets health insurance and who doesn't. We know that in rural communities, there's differential access to transportation. And then, of course, barriers related to language access and valuing cultural norms. And then once people get into the healthcare system, there's a lot of research and documentation that shows that there are differences in the quality of healthcare treatment that somebody can get based on their race, their ethnicity, their language, socioeconomic status, gender. So different treatments. There are elders in many communities who have firsthand experience of discrimination in the healthcare system. And then there's a lot of research emerging just around barriers related to doctor-patient communication. And then, of course, we talk about the social determinants of health. And these, we believe, are probably the primary drivers of health inequities, and that's related to where people live, their zip code, their wealth, their educational attainment, what's happening in their neighborhood, whether or not they have access to fresh fruits and vegetables that are affordable, and whether or not they're being targeted for marketing for alcohol, tobacco. And then, of course, the environment, so the housing conditions that they might live in. So health inequities are not about individual behavior, though undoing them will require individual behavior change, both in terms of what we eat and whether we exercise, but also in terms of what policies we make, how we plan our cities and our parks, how we educate our children, and where we invest our economic development resources. So the causes may definitely reach deeper than personal choice to the social determinants of equity. And Oregon has a number of examples that I won't go into too deeply related to health inequities, but they do relate to how we've treated the first residents of Oregon in terms of land and access to land and traditional practices, the ability to do business in Oregon, how we've housed our agricultural workers, and how we've marginalized certain communities. So the policies that have been in place either historically or recently have created systemic advantages for some populations and systemic disadvantages for others, and those accrue over generations and show up in our health status. So we can look at health disparities through a number of lenses. We can look at health disparities by breaking down our diagnosis data by race, ethnicity, and you've just heard about why we need better data to be able to understand that. We can look at geography, so the urban-rural divide, what does that look like? We can look by risk factor, and we know that some communities are targeted for increased substance abuse, that their behavioral practices in terms of nutrition, where we might see differences in terms of outcomes, and then, of course, looking by population. And we think a lot about race, ethnicity. It's not a part of the public discourse a lot of times, but we can also think about equity in terms of immigrant and refugee status, socioeconomic status, gender, age, and sexual orientation. So it's already touched on some of the causes of health inequities. I think this slide highlights that below those factors that we already talked about in terms of health care related or social determinants of health are societal factors, the isms related to racism, discrimination, and lack of political and economic power. And even within the healthcare system, there's an acknowledgement that even when you control for some of those other factors like disability status, diagnosis, age, severity of your condition, that there is still variation in medical care by race and ethnicity, and that there are a number of barriers for racial and ethnic minorities specifically for receiving even routine medical care, but less access to appropriate high-tech interventions and more access to the less desirable procedures like lower limb amputation for people with diabetes. So the Institute of Medicine report identified some strategies, and I'll spend just a couple minutes talking about some strategies for addressing health inequities. Their recommendations for reducing racial and ethnic disparities included increasing awareness about disparities among the general public, so just what we're doing here today and what a lot of the community-based organizations do every day. More minority healthcare providers was part of their recommendation, so because minority healthcare providers are more likely to serve in communities that have historically been underserved, as well as more healthcare interpreters to address issues of language access. So why is health inequity a priority? Why should we care? First of all, there's a real cost associated with this, and this is the result of a national study that just looked at 3 years, a three-year time period of looking at the direct health care cost and indirect costs to our economy for health inequities, and the dollar figure that they identified was $1.24 trillion. And we know that diversity is higher among low-income Oregonians. So within our Medicaid population, there's more than 40% of the population that's people of color. Eight counties in Oregon have Medicaid populations that are more than 50% non-white, and those are not urban, all urban counties. So they include Hood River in Jefferson County, Malheur, Marion, Morrow, Umatilla counties, as well as Washington and Multnomah counties. And diversity is growing in Oregon. If you look to the right side of the slide, you'll see the change between the 2000 census and the 2010 census, and see double-digit growth in communities of color in the past, in that 10-year period, including a 63% change in the Hispanic Latino population in Oregon. And our increase in diversity outpaces the national trend. So we're seeing more growth here in diversity than other places in the country. And some may be surprised to learn that diversity exists all over the state of Oregon. If you look at sort of the green and the blue areas, those are areas where there's a higher level of diversity. So you can see in like Klamath County, Jackson County, Deschutes, it's not countywide, it's located more of the city centers, Jefferson County, Morrow County, Hood River County. So there's a few things that I just want to point out about addressing health inequities, two ways to approach this. One that we're focusing mostly on today, which is looking at what are the improvements we can make within the medical model. But health systems transformation is really challenging us to integrate the medical approach as well as the public health approach. And while the solutions that we'll hear about today are focused more on the medical model, we're increasingly hearing from our community partners about their desire for us to focus more on the upstream causes of inequities, like healthy environment, quality education, transportation, and healthy housing. So the Joint Commission is an entity that accredits a number of healthcare providing organizations. And they recommend these practices: effective communication, cultural competence, patient and family-centered care, all as important components of quality care. And so that just highlighting that importance, the value of cultural competence. The National Public Health and Hospital Institute and the National Association of Public Hospitals, they developed a blueprint for healthcare equity, and they highlighted five strategies, one of which is partnerships with community, patients, and families, emphasizing the importance of executive leadership in valuing health equity and moving forward policies within their organizations. Again, culturally and linguistically appropriate care, metrics for equitable care, we've talked about that, and communication in the patient's language. And I think that extends both in terms of a language that's different from English, but also in terms of understanding the health literacy of the patients that are being seen. And then finally, I'll just end here. We've heard a lot today about NCQA certification. And the NCQA, the National Committee for Quality Assurance, actually has a multicultural healthcare distinction. And the five aspects that they highlight in terms of healthcare entities that want to achieve that healthcare distinction include, again, the things that we're talking about this afternoon and beyond: race, ethnicity, and language data collection, language access, culturally responsive practitioners, culturally and linguistically appropriate services, and the Office of Minority Health and the Department of Health and Human Services just released an expanded set of standards for culturally and linguistically appropriate services. And then finally, reducing healthcare disparities, which is really about quality assurance and quality improvement. So I can end there, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you very much, Tricia. Comment? All right, thank you everyone for testifying on this bill, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2134A and open a work session on House Bill 3128.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3128 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward moves House Bill 3128 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Excused.
Chairman
Sanders? Aye. Motion carries. Senator Knope, would you carry that one?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Senator Knope. And I close the work session on House Bill 3128 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2611A. And it looks like we have Ron Williams, Courtney Dresser, Jack Dempsey, and Mario Parker Milligan, whatever.
And Representative Kenny Geyer is coming back. Yeah. So.
And one of you will have to leave the chair if Representative Kenny Geyer comes by.
Good afternoon, Chair Monta Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ron Williams. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Action, a statewide grassroots advocacy organization. I'm here today representing the Oregon Cultural Competence Legislative Action Coalition, which consists of Oregon Action, the Oregon Student Association, Urban League of Portland, Basic Rights Oregon, Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, Center for Intercultural Organizing, and health professional organizations and individuals as well. We are here today in support of House Bill 2611A, Cultural Competence Continuing Education for Licensed Health Professionals. Ensuring health providers are equipped to effectively serve patients of all backgrounds and cultures has been shown to improve health care outcomes. We believe that all health professionals should receive training in cultural competency in order to reduce disparities in health care outcomes and build a healthier Oregon. 2611A was amended in the House, where it received significant bipartisan support and has achieved the support of the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Nurses Association, to name a few. HB 2611A does the following things. One, it requires licensing boards to track cultural competency continuing education credits taken by licensees. Two, requires licensing boards to report to Oregon Health Authority on participation of licensees in cultural competency education, and in turn, Oregon Health Authority will report to the Interim Legislative Health Committee on participation. Three, it permits Oregon Health Authority to continue to provide support for review and assessment of cultural competency coursework for licensing boards. Four, it allows licensing boards to expend existing funds for the purpose of tracking and reporting provisions. This legislation was reported a minimal fiscal impact. Five, clarifies the ability of health licensing boards to adopt rules under which they may require licensees to receive cultural competence continuing education. And six, allows that university or college health centers may require cultural competency training for licensees working in those settings. 2611A will help facilitate system-wide high-quality cultural competency training, which will in turn improve the standard of care for all Oregonians. The Oregon Cultural Competence Legislative Action Coalition believes this legislation will go a long way towards improving patient experience, increasing quality of care, and ultimately reducing costs, all key aims or key goals of the triple aim. Thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Let's hear the panel, and then we'll open it up for discussion.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Courtney Dresser here for the Oregon Medical Association. The OMA, as he mentioned, is supportive of House Bill 2611A. And we want to thank the sponsors of the bill and the coalition for working with the OMA and coming to us early on and taking our suggestions that to educate physicians and physician assistants on cultural competency that's best achieved through a voluntary process of continuing medical education opportunities. OMA has been working internally with our own folks and with our members as to make cultural competency a core policy issue. And we also have been members of the Cultural Competency Continuing Education Committee, which is in the Oregon Health Authority, and we'll continue to do that and work with our sponsors and our partners on this issue.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Mario Parker Milligan. Today I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Student Association. OSA represents over 100,000 students statewide from public universities and community colleges. This bill matters to us because we have healthcare centers on our college and university campuses, and a lot of us are the future doctors, nurses, and dentists of this great state. I've been working with LGBT students and students of color all across the state for the better part of a year now on addressing issues of cultural incompetence. Specifically, healthcare providers on our campuses and in our communities do not always have the tools they need to adequately provide safe and supportive healthcare. Students from marginalized communities often choose not to visit doctors and other healthcare professionals because they are afraid of being mistreated and often forced to explain their and our identities or educate their providers. Health is a necessity for academic success. When students have access to quality healthcare, they are less likely to miss class and more likely to achieve their educational goals. All of the Oregon University System schools provide some form of health insurance and access to licensed healthcare professionals. Unfortunately, those healthcare providers don't have the access to any sort of cultural competency trainings. Our college campuses are becoming hubs of diversity in our state, and as we take on more out-of-state students, international students, and encouraging safety and inclusion of LGBT students and students of color for recruitment and retention purposes, we have to be able to provide good and accessible health care to everyone. We need our campus doctors and nurses to be culturally competent so we don't have to take two buses to a doctor we can trust or avoid preventative screenings until we can get back home to a doctor who we can trust. As I've learned more about this issue, one student's story really struck out to me. Marco, a young LGBT-identified Latino student, once told me, "I, along with my family, have moved many times throughout our life, and as a result, he has had to change doctors. I've been in several situations with nurses where they've assumed because of his appearance and his family that he was unable he was a non-English speaker. This assumption made him feel uncomfortable, mad, and unwelcome. You may think this was a simple mistake, but simple mistakes often lead to complex ramifications. Some that can be prevented by asking the right questions and not making assumptions based on preconceived perceptions." Marco goes on to explain that his health care is improved when his doctors start with a clean slate and communicate with him despite their assumptions. Students of color face language and cultural barriers, and LGBT students are often expected to educate their doctors about their identities and needs. If our health professionals in Oregon are not being offered basic cultural competency trainings, they will be ill-equipped to serve the growing diversity of Oregon's population. More importantly, professionals will not be as competitive in the 21st century workplace, which is trending to be more inclusive and more accepting of a culturally competent work environment. It is time for cultural competency to be embedded into all basic medical trainings in our state because it's a proven way to improve health outcomes. This legislation is good for students and health professionals alike. This legislation is good for our state. I ask you to vote yes on HB 2611A. Cultural competency is just good health care. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Discussion?
A comment, Madam Chair. As those of you who've known me either in this committee or sitting on the other side of there over the years know, historically I've been opposed to bills like this, not because I don't believe in the reasons for them, but because I think that mandating continuing education having the legislature mandate continuing education professionals is dangerous territory to get into. It's delightful to me to be able to support this bill, and I really thank everybody for working so collaboratively and getting this to a point where it's so well thought out, so creative and inclusive. It's great parallel process for what we ought to be doing in educating healthcare providers, and I'm really excited about this bill. Great job, everybody. Really great.
And I have a history with this bill. Hopefully we're going to get it through. Both, it got through the House this time.
I'm hopeful this year.
Hopeful that we'll get it through the Senate. All right, Jack Dempsey and Representative Alyssa Kenny Geyer.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's great to be back here. Alyssa Kenny Geyer, House District 46, parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland. I'm sorry that I missed the previous testimony, and I don't really want to repeat it. I was meeting with my chair and vice chair of the House Healthcare Committee for our regular weekly chat, so thank you for letting me come down quickly and testify. I had something written about this. I probably will spare you that because probably a lot of it's been said, but this has been a great collaborative process. Delighted to have Oregon Nurses Association, Oregon Medical Association, a lot of the groups of Oregon Health Equity Alliance that are testifying here today. The bill that we heard previously on the data collection for health equity is kind of gets at the first piece, which is how do you figure out what's going on so you can design appropriate strategies. And this really gets at the second piece, which is making sure that our healthcare providers are equipped with the latest knowledge, skills, approaches in order to treat cultural issues more sensitively. Because you know that when you go into a health clinic, you're not just, you know, blood pressure and height and weight and things like that. You are the culture that you come with, and we will never design good strategies if we are not aware of all the cultural factors that are. You know, that influence people's decisions and behavior. Senator Steiner Hayward mentioned, there was resistance, a lot of concern around mandates, and you know, was that really, was the infrastructure there to allow different licensees to be able to do that? Is that really what we should be doing? And I think this bill, as a compromise bill, that says, these boards of licensees will work with Oregon Health Authority to really see what the best, you know, the evidence-based practices is in culturally competent care. They're spending a lot of time figuring out what are the trainings that have been developed over 30 years. This is a very long history to this field, are most appropriate. And for the boards that feel that for their professions, this is an important training, and that everyone, all of their licensees should do it, it allows them that ability to do it if they'd like. And it allows community colleges and colleges for their licensed practitioners in their health clinics to mandate that as a condition of employment if they feel that that's what they need to best serve their patients. So I'm really delighted by this bill. I appreciate all the cooperation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead, Jack, and then we'll open it up.
Thank you. Jack Dempsey, representing the Oregon Nurses Association, happy to put our support behind House Bill 2611A. The nursing community has been working on this the last couple of years, particularly our state workforce center, the Oregon Center for Nursing, has made this cultural competency, has made that a priority. They've held a couple of conferences on this in the last couple of years, and I'm excited about this bill, and I appreciate that the flexibility that was added into this to allow the boards to roll this out kind of as they see fit in the best way for the folks that they license. So I'm just happy to support this bill.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion. And there's no opponents that I'm aware of to this bill. This is only scheduled for a public hearing, but I'm sure that we will bring it back for a work session. I'm not sure when, but we will. All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on 2611A, and I just wanted everyone to know today is Nurses Day, and so all those nurses out there, it's week, and I noticed the nurse, fellow nurse, is there. I don't know if there are any others out there, but with that, we're adjourned.